Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Taksim Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk by Lama Kathy Wesley is entitled Lamas, Rituals, and Aspirations, Tibetan Buddhism Explained. When Western scholars began to study Tibetan Buddhism decades ago, they called it Lamaism because of its emphasis on the role of the teacher as a spiritual guide for the aspiring student. But what is a Lama? And what's the function of ritual and aspiration in the Tibetan Buddhist path? This talk explores these questions and opens the door to understanding Tibetan Buddhist theory and practice. Enjoy the podcast.
Should I do the show and tell first, or do you want to like spend the whole teaching wondering what's in the box? All right. Okay. We'll do it. We'll do it now. Although it fits right in with the topic, because those of you who are familiar know that our topic for today is Lamas, Rituals, and Aspiration, the Tibetan Buddhist Path Explained. Part of the reason I wanted to talk about this particular topic this week is because so many people say to me, what is different about Tibetan Buddhism? How is it different from other forms of Buddhism? Well, to accurately answer that question, I would have to have studied all of the kinds of Buddhism, and I haven't. So because I haven't studied all the forms of Buddhism, I can't accurately answer that question. But what I can say is I can say a few things about the Tibetan Buddhist path and what makes the Tibetan Buddhist path unique. And so among the things that makes the Tibetan Buddhist path unique are our reliance upon spiritual guides or teachers, and we call them lamas, and I'll explain what that word means, and a little bit about, we also rely on what is called mantra practice. I'm calling it ritual practice in the title of my talk because that's what it looks like to a lot of people. When you practice mantra, such as the compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, it may seem as though you're putting together some sort of ritual something. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and because that's another thing that makes Tibetan Buddhism unique, is the reliance on and the practice of mantra. And the last one is about aspiration, because aspiration is something that I guess you could say fuels our path. A lot of people come into a Buddhist shrine room for the first time to learn how to meditate because they aspire to something for themselves. They aspire to more peace through the practice of meditation, a more inner stability through the practice of meditation. They also aspire to make the lives of themselves and their families and loved ones better by practicing a spiritual discipline. So you could say that aspiration is with us from the moment we walk through the door. We're aspiring for something. We wish for something. And I know that when I was a child, I read a lot of books, fiction books about magic, and there was a lot about wishing. There was a lot about wishing in those children's magic books. And sometimes because wishing is associated with magic and something unreal, wishing gets a bad rap. So I'm here to try to renew our acquaintance with wishing and aspiration and to tell you it's not so bad to wish or to aspire for something, especially if we can follow it up with some type of constructive action that helps us be better people and helps us to carry out those aspirations. As one teacher once said, you can make the aspiration that you will win the lottery, but if you never buy a ticket, it's probably not going to happen. And it's like that. If we aspire to Buddhahood, but then don't apply ourselves to practice and self-knowledge, then it's going to be a little hard to attain that Buddhahood. So it's a little bit about what I'm going to talk about today. I guess the box is going to have to wait just a few minutes, but it's going to fit in It's going to fit in because what's in this box has to do with our topic. So it's good. So let's start with llamas, because that was the original, the important first topic. When I first started reading about Tibetan Buddhism when I was a child in encyclopedias, they called it, they didn't call it Buddhism, they called it Lamaism, as though Lamaism were a specific kind of religion about llamas. Well, of course, you know, it takes you a while to understand that they're talking about the person llama and not the animal llama, but, you know, it's a spelling thing. But the word llama means insurpassable mother. That's what it means, because la of llama is, it's part of the Tibetan phrase Lama Depa, which you don't have to remember. I just have to remember because I have to explain it from time to time. The la means insurpassable, unexcelled. The idea is that it's unsurpassed. And then Lana Ma Depa means unsurpassed, but ma really does refer to mother. It really does refer to the parent. And so the Lama is the insurpassable parent for sentient beings. Now, not just anybody can be a Lama. Although people who look at me may say, what was the criteria exactly? But what happens is that there in the Tibetan religious system, the Tibetan religious system started with teachers coming to Tibet from India. And those teachers who came to Tibet from India were widely respected. The reason they were widely respected was because they embodied, to a certain extent, the qualities that are spoken about in Buddhist texts. They do their best to practice the six perfect virtues of generosity and ethics and patience, diligence, meditation, and wisdom. They do their best to try to observe the 10 skillful actions and not observe the 10 unskillful actions. They do their best to be to learn the Dharma and to present it with honesty and clarity and with compassion, and at least as much patience as they can pull together on any given day. Because lamas are not automatically enlightened beings. Although it would be so great if they gave that to you along with the title. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. So in the Tibetan religious tradition started with lamas, people coming, teachers coming from other parts of the Buddhist world to teach. Then those lamas were supported by monastic communities. Monastic communities grew up around different physical communities, actual geographic communities. Lots of communities had monasteries. And in those monasteries lived monks and or nuns. And those monks or nuns practiced from morning till evening the practices of meditation and mantra and compassion. Those three jhanas of Tibetan Buddhism. The Hinayana is self-liberation through the practice of meditation and ethics. The Mahayana is the liberation for all through the practice of self-compassion and compassion for others. And Vajrayana is coming to know and to cultivate one's own inner Buddha, one's own inner Buddha nature, through the practice of mantra, visualization, and deep meditation. And so these three jhanas were taught by the lamas who came, and then the lamas started monastic communities where people lived dedicated lives of practice. And so from this then developed the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that we know today. Are all monks lamas, and are all lamas monks? That's the question many people ask. It's what is that old one? Is Socrates a man, or is man Socrates? Anyway, there's this one old philosophical proof that I can never remember. But monastics are not necessarily lamas, but they are devoted to Dharma practice from morning to night. In fact, they usually live separated from the rest of society. They don't marry. They don't have children. and they devote themselves 100% to the practice of Buddhism from morning to night and all through the night. So the monastic has made a lifestyle choice to leave home, as it were, and become a follower of the Buddha in the most strict sense. Because the Buddha left home. He became a renunciate. And so, like the Buddha, these men and women who become monks and nuns leave home and become renunciates, just like the Buddha did, and practice to the best of their ability to become like the Buddha, using all of the methods of practice that are available to them. So, from among these monks and nuns, there are some lamas. So how do lamas become lamas? I can only speak for my tradition, the Karmakaju tradition, which is only one small tradition of a giant subject called Tibetan Buddhism. There are four main traditions of Tibetan Buddhism and then many, many, many sub-traditions. So I'm only speaking for one tiny piece of Tibetan Buddhism when I say that in our tradition, lamas come from training. They require that a person undergo a 3-year, 3-month, 3-day retreat, either alone or with a group. And in that 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, they teach that person everything there is to know about the main meditation practices of the tradition. We learn lots of mantras in retreat, and we do lots of mantras in retreat. And we do lots of shamatha in retreat, we do lots of tonglen in retreat, and we do lots of mahamudra meditation in retreat. When we come out, we're a little dazed, if you can imagine that, because we haven't had the connection to society that everybody else has had. We don't get the newspapers. We don't listen to the radio or watch television or have internet. And so because of that, we only get news that is filtered into us through letters. And so as a result, we're somewhat removed, which is good, because then it gives us the opportunity to put our minds to our practices and our studies. Unless, of course, you're like me and you write a letter every single day. Probably it was a big time waster for me to write a letter every day to somebody. Listen, please, somebody. I'm so lonely. That's a joke. Because you're not really lonely in retreat, because you really get to know your fellow retreatants super well, and they know you super well, which is good most of the time. They also know all your faults. Anyway, so then... at the conclusion of the 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, there's a graduation ceremony, and hopefully before that, we will have had an interview with our retreat master to say, well, what do you want me to do? And they'll say, I think it's time for you to go back into retreat again, or they will say, I think that you need to do this or do that, and I think this or that, or in my case, he just said, go back to the KTC you came from and help them. And then he said, when you have time, he said, travel and teach at the other KTCs because they don't have lamas. And so that was my job interview. And this was in English because a translator was not available. And so I said, so what do you want me to do, Rinpoche? And he gave me this list of practices that went from morning to evening. And I said, Rinpoche, if I do all that practice, when am I going to work? And then in English, he said, little working, okay, but now you do Dharma. So that was my job interview, and they started calling me Lama after that. And then he reminded me. He said, "Remember," he said, "you're just a little Lama. You are not a big Lama. You're just a little Lama." And so, if other Lamas go through what I went through, what happens is you begin to interact with Dharma students, and they ask you questions you cannot answer. They ask you questions you cannot answer. So you go back to your retreat master and say, okay, this is what they're asking me now. And then you get the answer, and hopefully you remember to write it down and take it to the person, and then it becomes part of your internal Rolodex of information. Oh, I used a word. It's an old address book. Never mind. Anyhow, it becomes part of your database of information. It becomes part of your database of information. But the hard thing is that you have to both teach and continue working on your own practice, because the part they don't tell you is that you get the title without being enlightened. And so what you'll hear me say frequently is that it really stinks not to be enlightened. Really stinks, because I lose my patience, I lose my temper, I have all kinds of bad habits, and this and that and the other thing. But still, I sit here in front of you from time to time and try my best to recall what Kemp Rinpoche told me is important for us to study. And so being a Lama is difficult, but if people do it and they keep their own practice up at the same time, slowly and gradually over time, they will get more patient, relatively lose their temper less often, and so forth. So that's the goal. So we're all in the same boat together. Even though Kemp Rinpoche asked me to sit here, I'm actually in both places at once. And so that's why when many people say, I'm asking a silly question, I'll say, oh, no, you're not. I may not know the answer, so it's okay. But there are special lamas, and to them we give special honor. And people like Kempo Carter Rinpoche are such people. And he was the founder of our center and retains the position of being our spiritual master and guide. He guides us in all things. And because of his role as our guide, you'll hear me quote him quite a lot. And I go to him for advice and information. I still do this, even though they gave me the Lama title. As long as he is available to me, I am not going to fail to make use of him. So although I may fail to follow his advice properly, but I will not fail to ask. And I hope that all of you do get a chance to meet him. How many people have not met him? Okay, we'll see if we can fix that. We'll find a way to get you there so that you can actually see him and have a sense of his caring for you. He's just remarkable. And it's because the Karmapa, the 16th Karmapa, asked him to be here for us in 1976 when he was ill in the hospital, nearly dead from tuberculosis. He made a promise that if he was able to get well, he prayed to the Karmapa to help him to get well, and he said, whatever you tell me to do, I will do. Not too long after that, making that prayer, he got message from the 16th Karmapa, wanted to see him, and said, I want you to go to America. So he was like, okay, you're answering my prayer, I'm going to America. And so because of the qualities that Kempo Carter Rinpoche exhibits, the qualities of generosity, patience, ethics, diligence, meditation, and wisdom, because of the qualities that he represents, we go to him for advice. We say to him, Rinpoche, what should I do? And the fact of the matter is, because he has lived so long and been involved with so many Dharma students, he pretty much knows what is going on with us and how we live and so forth. He's been in America for so long that he understands us in ways that other people don't. And so having him as our guide is, even though he never learned English, and he apologizes for this, he said, I think I was too old when I got here and I just never learned it. So he says, I really need to apologize to all of you because I should have learned it. But even though he's not easy to meet or to speak with, he still remains a focus for our devotion and our aspiration. So that's, I think, why the Westerners who first studied Tibetan Buddhism called it Lamaism, because we honor the Lama as the person who gives us the advice that helps us find our way. Because Buddhism is huge, if you haven't noticed. Buddhism is huge, and there's all kinds of subjects we could study, and if we tried to study them all, we might succeed in studying them all, but we may not understand them all. So this is where the Lama comes in, because the Lama helps us to figure out what is useful for us to study, what will help us the most, and what we can do, what we can best do with our time practicing. As the author of the 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva, Mudjil Togme, as he says, he said, if in reliance upon someone your defects wane and your qualities increase like the waxing moon, then to cherish such a person is the practice of a bodhisattva. So the idea here is that the text actually says cherish more than your own life. But we're not there yet. So, but we can cherish them. When reliance upon someone, that means if we practice the Lama's advice and we get benefit from it, that's a good sign. If we practice the Lama's advice and don't get benefit from it, well, that means this may not be our Lama and we may need to find another. But the idea here is to continue to do our best to practice. And as we practice, we will come into contact with more teachers. And from among those teachers, we will find the teachers whose advice helps us the most. And those will become our branch teachers. They actually use the word branch and root in Tibetan Buddhism, like the branch and root of a tree. So, so then from among the branch teachers, gradually over a period of time, we will find those whose advice helps us the very most, and those will become our root teachers. And those are the people who you could go to and say, wow, Rinpoche, I just finished a retreat. What do you want me to do now? I was at that place where I could say to him, what do you want me to do? And he would tell me, and I would go, okay, I can do that. And I went back to him a few years later and said, you know, Rinpoche, I always regretted that I never did another retreat. So, because they always say one's good, two's better, three's even better than that, and four, you're perfect. Yeah, someday you'll meet Lama Soltram Gyaltsen, who did 4 3-year retreats. He's amazing. He's from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, eh? He's a Youper. Anyway, he's just an average guy, but he's done 12 years of meditation in retreat. Wow. Anyway, but I went back to Rinpoche and said, well, I feel guilty I never did another one. And I said, so do you think I need to do another one? And he did that like consulting the universe thing. And then he said, no, that won't be necessary. And then I said, so what do you want me to do with the rest of my life? I mean, you never know when you're going to have a chance to ask that question ever again. So I said, so what do you want me to do with the rest of my life? He said, do what you're doing right now. Do it till you can't do it anymore. And I said, okay, so I can do that. And so that's why I'm still here. Somebody asked me the other day, what's your succession plan for the KTC Columbus? And I said, he's in 3-year retreat right now. Because Adam Berner is in 3-year retreat right now. So I don't know. There's no guarantee he will return to Columbus. But he has family here, so it's likely. So we'll get to see somebody fresh out of retreat with that deer in the headlights look. They're not used to being with more than one person at a time, so it's a little bit challenging. Actually, more than like however many people are in their retreat. I had 7 or 8 people in my retreat. When numbers got beyond that, it was a little bit unusual. They say of the Lama that the Lama is the three jewels of symbolic of the three jewels of refuge: the Buddha, who is our teacher; the Dharma, that's our path; and the Sangha, who's our community. They say the Lama's. Let's see if I get this. The mind is the Buddha, the speech is the Dharma, and the body is the Sangha. So the idea is that that's why for people who didn't have an image of the Buddha, they could think of their Lama and pray to their Lama, and then receive blessing from that. So that's a little bit about Lamaism and how that happened. And for us in the United States, we're very fortunate that there are lots of Lamas living here. And so we can meet many and from among them find those Lamas whose advice gives us the best, most benefit. But we also have practice. And the practice of shamatha, quiet sitting, is a foundation for all of us as Buddhists. And it is actually helps us to understand ourselves better, because when we understand our thoughts better, we understand our minds better, and then we can see what we need to work on. Not only that, other people will continuously tell us what we need to work on. You're not very patient, or you need to be more generous, so forth and so on. So slowly over time, the practice of shamatha helps us to see what's going on with us and see what to do. Then the practice of tonglen, or compassion meditation, helps us to feel compassion for ourselves and compassion for other people. it's based on shamatha, because shamatha is just that breath awareness meditation where you're aware of the breath coming in and coming out. Well, Tonglen, you put a motivation on the breath as it goes out. You think, may all beings be happy. And as you breathe in, you think, may all beings be free of suffering. And so by doing these simple practices of Tonglen, we increase, at least in our minds and our hearts, the compassion we feel for ourselves and for others. And mantra practice, the Vajrayana practice, helps to introduce ourselves to the world that is within us. Shamatha gives us a clue that there's more going on inside than we may have counted on, and that there's more to us than just our chatter of thoughts. There's something deep and peaceful within us that we can access through meditation. And when we do compassion practice, we see that there's compassion in there we didn't even know we had. And then with Vajrayana mantra practice, we begin to relate to the idea that we may actually have Buddha nature. Buddha nature may just be real. Right now, to us, Buddha nature is a theory. It's a theory. Okay, my teacher told me I have Buddha nature, so I'm willing to give him or her the benefit of the doubt. But we may not really grasp it. But if we learn mantra practice, that might give us a method for actually experiencing it for ourselves just for a moment. Let's use the Chenrezig practice as an example. When we do Chenrezig practice, we use our imagination, because our imagination helps us to stretch beyond what we think we can do. Right now, we feel somewhat, shall we say, hemmed in by our bodies. Those of us who are getting older feel even more hemmed in than others. It's creaking and cracking in places it didn't before, and I'm beginning to realize, oh yeah, the women in my family died in their 70s. Oh dear, I'm 64. What will happen? Anyway, so I'm getting good health care. Don't worry. I'm doing my part. But in any case, we feel limited right now by our bodies and our thoughts. I'm the kind of person who thinks like this. I'm the kind of person who likes this. I'm the kind of person who doesn't like that. So we feel sort of limited and hemmed in by our habits and our thoughts and our bodies. So in mantra meditation, we use our imagination to go beyond that. Why do you think we read books? To go beyond what we think we're capable of. Why do you think we see theater? To go beyond and to think differently than what we thought before. Why do we like dance and music? Because it takes us out of our humdrum and takes us to a place of beauty and truth. And so the Vajrayana uses our imagination to do that. So in Chenrezig practice, Chenrezig is the name of the Bodhisattva of compassion. So in Chenrezig practice, we imagine above our head is the image of Chenrezig. We imagine that Chenrezig is actually present in a small white form above our heads. We imagine that we're in the presence of an enlightened being. Or we could imagine that he's in front of us and that we're surrounded by all the beings of the world and that he's shining there in front of us. And we place our palms together and say, I take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha from now until enlightenment is reached. Through the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I attain Buddhahood for the sake of all that lives. And then we imagine that white light comes from his form and purifies us, and purifies our motivations, purifies our karma, purifies our confusion, and our lack of compassion for ourselves and others. And then we imagine he dissolves into us and blesses us. What a lovely thing. What a lovely thing to use our imagination to go beyond who we think we are. But wait, there's more. If you move on to the second half of the meditation, the second part of the meditation, we see him above our head, and we think that he is all of our teachers. This beautiful light-made form is all of our teachers and all of the Buddhas and all of the Bodhisattvas in one figure. And then we say, Lord, we address him, Lord, not stained by any fault, whose body shines in light, gazing with compassion on top of a lotus flower holding a lotus and rosary, Chenrezig, to you I bow. So we basically say, may I become like you. May I have your qualities. May I have your compassion. May I have your wisdom. And so we use our imagination to make that aspiration. And so making that aspiration then, we imagine that light comes from his form and shines upon us and purifies us of absolutely everything that's wrong. All that stuff we've never been able to forgive ourselves for. All that stuff we pretend we've gotten past but is still with us. All of those things that feel imperfect and not right. We allow him through the agency of our imagination, we allow him to remove all of those faults. And then we imagine that our body is transformed into the body of Chenrezig, that it's shining in light, that it's not solid, not made of concrete, not made of flesh, that it's actually made of light, and yet it is empty inside, and that we glow with this light of awakening. And so we use our imagination to think what it must be like to be a Buddha for just a short time. And then we recite his mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And by reciting his mantra, which is his name, a form of his name, we imagine that the love that he exemplifies is spread throughout the world. Just for that short, wonderful period of time, we use our imagination to change the world to what it could be, what it should be, this world of wisdom and compassion. Then, when we have finished, we use our imagination again, dissolving all of the beings in the world who are now also Chenrezi, all the people we had a quarrel with, all the people we don't like, all the people who we've hurt or who've hurt us. We imagine all of them dissolving into light and then merging with the Chenrezi above our head, who then merges with us. And we receive his blessing for real. And then we dissolve into light from the top to the middle and the bottom to the middle into our heart, into a small dot of white light that then disappears. And in that moment, we experience our mind without concepts. It might last for 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, but then thoughts begin again. And then we re-visualize ourselves as Chenrezig, all the beings in the world as Chenrezig, and this world is a pure realm. And so that's how Vajrayana practice works. It shows us for a moment what it might be like to be a Buddha. And it shows us for a moment, in that moment of quiet, after we dissolve everything, what it is to be a Buddha. And then, from there, we reawaken as our ordinary selves, but with a different view, the view of Chenrezig, the view of compassion and wisdom. And so that is a little bit about ritual. We talked about lamas. Now we talked a little bit about ritual or mantra practice, which the mantra practice helps us to transform our ideas of who we are and who we could be. And finally, I want to say a couple things about aspiration, and then we'll do Q&A, and then we'll do this. Aspiration, as I said at the beginning, is sort of how we get started on the path. We aspire to be different or better than we are. We aspire to be like the lamas who we've seen. This is really the function of the lama in our life, is they give us a view of what is possible. They give us a view of what we could be, even if they're not perfect. Kempo Rinpoche said, was asked once, well, what if your lama is an imperfect, flawed person? And you pray to this imperfect, flawed person. What then? And he said, don't worry. He said, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will hear you, and they will answer your prayers. So you don't need to worry about that, which I thought was kind of interesting. So the lama gives us an idea of what might be possible. The practice helps to take us there. And that when we get that viewpoint for ourselves, we will realize the fruition of our aspiration. So anyway, I could go on and on and on and talk. It might not be interesting, but we might be able to have a discussion And then I can tell you why it is so cool that Tracy brought me this box today, because it actually feeds right into what we're talking about. So we have time for maybe two or three questions. The microphone is open for you. And he's actually going to turn it on. Thank you, Joseph. By the way, thanks to everybody who showed up at ComFest yesterday. We had 10 people on the stage, and Joseph was out in the audience filming us, and it was good. I already met somebody who wants a copy, so I'll email you. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning.
Or afternoon.
Where do you learn Chenrezig? Like, can we practice it here?
Funny you should ask. No, I really appreciate that question. Where can you learn Chenrezig? Funny you should ask. Yeah, we can teach you here. There are two ways to learn. There are infrequent, occasional classes, but there are a few people who could mentor you. This is really interesting that you should. I mean, this is like ooh, because while I was supposed to be paying attention in Chenrezig Puja today, I'm sitting there thinking, ooh, that person could be a Chenrezig mentor. That person could teach people how to chant. Ooh, that person could teach them how to do this or that. So, your question came through. So I think that's one way to do it. What I would do if I were you is contact me, and then I will, if I'm able to give you an instruction, I will. And if I cannot give you an instruction, we'll do your instruction in two parts, where you learn the chanting first and then you learn the visualization. But I would encourage you, even if you have not learned everything there is to learn about Chenrezig, that you come to the Tuesday night practice at 7 anyway, even though you're not familiar with it. Because when I talk to people about how to learn a mantra practice, what I tell them is it's kind of like a theater piece. Because theater pieces start with the words, right? And the stage directions come in later. So first you learn the words. I don't mean you have to memorize the sadhana. I just mean you have to become familiar with their meaning in English and in Tibetan. Just become familiar, which you can do as you read and chant with the group. You slowly get better at chanting with the group, and as you slowly get better, you slowly absorb the meaning. You can take a copy home and read it. I have copies to give people, so you don't have to borrow ours. I have copies that I can send you by email that you can read and learn and absorb. And so the words come first. And then gradually the melodies come. We get the melodies all straightened out. And so the words, the melodies, and then we start to teach the visualization. And there's a simplified format on lamakathy.net called Chenrezig for Beginners. And it's just the basics of visualization with the text. So thank you for asking. And like I say, you can find me through the Columbus KTC website. LamaKathy@ColumbusKTC.org. You can write, and I'll help you out. But just show up on Tuesday nights. Chuck, you're leading this week, right? Okay, so Chuck will be there this week, and I think Michael Brennan is in. Em's going to be there, so yeah, you got folks that'll be there. So it's all good. I'm looking.
I spy with my little eye a person named Tanya. Hi, Tanya.
Yeah, I spy with my little eye. Oh, that's okay. Well, she's our. I'm sorry to embarrass you, hon. I do apologize. She's. I call her my Chenrezig captain, because she helps the Chenrezig omses, or the chant leaders, to be where they need to be when they need to be. So she helps them out. So, other questions? Are there any other questions? Yes, sir.
I was going to use the microphone, but I have to use my teacher voice.
Sure.
I got a three-parter for you.
Wow, three-parter. Okay.
First, you had talked about diligence and one of the six perfections.
Yeah.
Expand upon that some more. Second, you have a personal story of diligence in your own life. And third, could you offer us some resources as far as readings about diligence?
Yeah, thanks. I love the questions I'm getting today. I must have Kempo Rinpoche. I often think that, well, I pray to Kempo Rinpoche because he's been my lama for like 40 years, right? So it's like we grew old together, you know. He's 95 and I'm almost 65. I mean, it's a thing. So I prayed to him and I asked him for help, and he gave me two interesting questions. Funny you should ask that question, John, because that's what I'm talking about next. That is actually the topic. One of my topics in July is diligence. It's about joyful effort and how we develop that. So I'll give a longer talk about that now. I mean then, now. Where am I? I'll give a longer talk about that then, but just to be brief, Karmapa talked a little bit about this at the teaching he gave at Riverside Church. He said, if we look at our Dharma practice as being like a burden that we have to carry, just another darn thing we have to do, he said, that's maybe not diligence. You know, he said, you have to see your Dharma practice as being like an antidote for what's going on with you. And then he says, if you can see it that way and see that it's making you a more constructive person, he said, then maybe you'll be disposed toward doing it for the reasons of benefiting yourself and others. And he said, and then as you begin to see the benefits show in your life from your meditation, then that will give you diligence of a joyful kind rather than a heavy responsibility kind. Does that make sense? But I will go into that more in depth in the future. The place to read about it that I would recommend for anybody would be to read the chapter on the six perfections that's in Kempo Carter Rinpoche's book, Dharma Paths, P-A-T-H-S, Dharma Paths, because he explains diligence in a very accessible way. Not a lot of highfalutin language, but a real pragmatic approach. And that's what I'm going to be basing part of my talk on, is that section on diligence in Dharma Paths. You can also read about it I'm trying to think of other good resources on the six perfections. Pema Chodron talks about diligence at length in her commentary on Shantideva. And her commentary is entitled, No Time to Lose. She comments on an 8th century text on the six perfections. And the diligence chapter is really kind of heavy deal. And then she makes it understandable. So I would read that. The Jewel Ornament of Liberation is the other resource, but it's a little denser and a little harder to understand. So I'd start with those two, and then we'll talk about Jewel Ornament. And then a story from my own life. Let me tell you a story about Kempo Carter Rinpoche first. For 7 years, many of you know this, for 7 years I worked as a helper on the board of trustees of our home monastery, Karma Triana Dharma Chakra, which is a 501c3 at the national level. And because it was a very different group, it was very diverse. The group was very diverse. There were frequently conflicts, and it would be hard for me sometime to separate my own personal opinion about something from something else. So I would fall into these situations of thinking of other people in negative ways and all of this sort of thing. So I would go to Kempo Rinpoche and ask for his advice, and he would give me advice. And I asked him one time, I said, sort of, well, how is it that you can like deal with all this? Because he's on that board as well. And he just always looks so serene. You know, everything, all kinds of chaos is erupting around him, and people are having bad opinions about each other and expressing it. I mean, you know, and so he's just sitting there so serenely. And at first I thought it was because he didn't understand enough English. But no, he understands a lot of what's being said. And he said, I'll tell you what. He said, I've been through a lot. I've been through a lot. And he said, ever since Karmapa gave me the job of being the Lama at KTD Monastery, he said, I have never lost my enthusiasm for serving him and carrying out his wish. I've never lost my enthusiasm for serving His Holiness. And I think that's kind of hard for folks to understand. How could you never lose your enthusiasm? So maybe he is a little farther down the path than you or me. But that's what he said. He said, I've never lost my enthusiasm. And so I have to tell you that him saying that helped me a lot, because that's how I have always felt. I have no idea why. Maybe it's karma, maybe it's something, but I've never lost my enthusiasm for serving the you know, Kemper Vache, the Sangha, the centers. If you want to get me all frothy and talking a lot, you can ask me about KTC teaching programs, and then I get all excited about that, and I'll talk endlessly. If you want advice about, like, how do you engage people at a KTC, because I visit other KTCs and they ask my advice, you know, and so I get all excited about it, because that's my love. My love is working with people and helping create the structures that will help them practice. So I guess that's maybe not a good story. Maybe there'll be another story that will be better, but that's all I can do right now. But I might come up with a better one by the time the lecture comes around. What was the last question? I did. What was the last one, though?
It was talk a little more about it.
Oh, and then where to read more. Okay, yeah, okay. I did get them. Okay. Okay. Well, then if there aren't any more questions, is there any burning question? I can get to the box. No burning question? Okay.
Yeah, what's in the box?
Okay, that's a burning question on everybody's mind, is what's in the box? Well, I've been hanging around the Tibetans for a long time. And because I've been hanging around the Tibetans for a long time, I've kind of taken on some of their habits. And one of their habits is attempting to read relative truth, meaning auspicious signs and things like this. Like yesterday, it was so delightful that we had a tiny sprinkle of rain before the chant started, and then when we actually asked for Chenrezig to be present, the sun came out. I thought that was PDC, pretty darn cool. And then the other night I was doing something important, and I was driving somewhere, and I saw a rainbow form behind me, and I'm like, "Thanks, Rinpoche, I know you're with me." And then one of the column that I have written, I still call them columns, I don't know, maybe they're blogs, anyway, that I've written for this coming week is about this unusual thing that happened at Riverside Church when we were raising money for the KTC. Out of nowhere, this really beautiful woman appeared out of nowhere. She's all in white because Karmapa had asked all of the people attending the program to wear white. She's all dressed in white, highly fashionable, really, really high fashion haircut, high fashion manicure, high fashion everything, incredibly graceful, beautiful woman. And she just walked right up to our table where we had like malas and books, and she just scooped them up and made a little pile in the center of the table. I'll take this, and I'll take this, and I'll take this, and this. And by the time we took her credit card, it was more than $4,000. And I said to the people at the table, I said, Rinpoche and His Holiness have sent us a generosity dakini. This woman out of nowhere just handed us money. And then people kept doing it after that. But it was very interesting. So today, I am delighted to tell you that for the last, this is the third day of a three-day puja for a longevity puja for Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's 95th birthday. They're doing it at the home monastery. I had important things to be here for this week in Columbus, so I couldn't go. Oh, but that's all right. I'm going to go to the one. I've kind of gotten the word like yesterday that I can't miss the one in August, so I may renege on a couple things and have to switch my schedule a bit to be there, but anyway, they're doing this huge puja. And the day before yesterday, Sue Ellen Steinmetz, who is there for representing us, and Kathy Jackson, they got their dollar bills together, and they counted them out and put them in envelopes and did something called kunge. Kun means all and ge means virtuous. And it basically means that you give an offering to every single person who is at a prayer gathering. Well, that's very difficult when there's 500 people at a prayer gathering, so they usually only give it to the people who have robes on. So That's what they did. They gave little offerings to every single person who was wearing a robe. That's about 100 people. And asked them to pray for the Columbus KTC. So I'm feeling pretty happy about that. Because prayers are good. I mean, just basically prayers are good. And then today, I got this treasure chest from Tracy. And I said, another auspicious thing has happened. And that is this here. These are books that were rescued from the fire. And they were even labeled by me. Like probably in the 1980s based on where I got these pictures, things from. The commentary on the Tunshi Laminal Jor of the 8th Karmapa's Guru Yoga, the protector practice of Mahakala, and then Karma Pakshi. So we don't know precisely if that's what all these are or if maybe I have mislabeled them, but I'm definitely sure that this one is the commentary on the Four Sessions Guru Yoga by the 8th Karmapa. So I think we just got a message from Karmapa. Everything is going to be okay. And as if to help make that point, the remover of obstacles, interestingly wrapped in green, Tara from our shrine has been returned. So we have a Dakini, and we have the Dharma. So we have the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha kind of all here with us. So I think the message is, it's going to be okay. So slowly, piece by piece, all things will come together. And so there we have some reassurance. So isn't that sweet? I think it's, and you can come visit them. We're going to repatriate them to the shrine. But I just think that's lovely. I have to talk to the shrine keeper first. Okay, well, we'll have to figure out what to do. All right. So thank you for listening to the talk and having this just blew my mind to see these today. I'm so happy. And by the way, they smell pretty good. What did you say? Baking soda?
They've been in the charcoal
and baking soda for 2 years. Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. So these were blasted by fire hoses, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they okay. Yeah. And now individual pages can be read. So, okay. Well, let's stop here and mentally dedicate the merit of our session today to all sentient beings. We dedicate this merit that all beings feel confidence in themselves and in the Dharma, and that all beings are free from suffering, come to happiness, and then to Buddhahood. And coming to Buddhahood, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings everywhere. We dedicate the merit with this thought in mind.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.